Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.
It's Tuesday, November 13th, 2018, and this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news and culture magazine. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Carrie Klein. The elections are over, mostly, but the consequences are still rippling throughout the region. In today's episode, we follow up on surprising results in races for the Kern County Board of Supervisors and a local state Senate district. We ask why Proposition 3, the latest water bond, won locally but failed statewide. And we chat with veterans about their memories from wartime.
But first, let's take a look at why a powerful campaign to improve and add to Fresno's parks didn't pass. Yes on P spent millions trying to get voters to align with its vision to create more green spaces in a city bereft of them. But there were plenty of opponents, including Mayor Lee Brand. FM 89's Laura Satsui nails down some of the reasons why voters didn't support a sales tax to fund overdue park improvements.
If Measure P had passed, it would have created a 3/8-cent sales tax to fund parks and trail maintenance and arts programming over the next 30 years. The Yes on P campaign was advocating for safe, clean parks. But in one ad from a Measure P opposition group called Fresnans for a Safer Community, No on P, Police Chief Jerry Dyer says this.
We oppose Measure P because it takes away our ability to hire the additional personnel needed to keep Fresno safe.
It's comments like these that have infuriated Sandra Celadon. She's the executive director of Fresno Building Healthy Communities. She thinks the opponents of Measure P were intentionally deceptive.
There was over 100 organizations that endorsed Measure P and only four groups that opposed it. And that was our mayor, the Chamber of Commerce, the Fresno Police Association, and the fire department. And so this really boils down to just greed. They wanted to show force. They wanted to show that they're the most important in town. And they really wanted to make sure that they got every dime that comes into our city.
Celadon isn't just talking about the police chief. Fresno Mayor Lee Brand also supported the No on P campaign.
I think right now there's a lot of disillusionment with the mayor, not only because of the fact that he didn't stand up for parks. That would have been okay, right? We know mayors have different priorities, but it was the way he failed to lead, and that was with lies.
Brand says it's not the opposition message that swayed voters. It's that voters disagreed with the measure.
Roughly half the voters didn't buy the argument of the parks measure. And I think because, one, I don't think they got their message resonated. I think people knew there were other issues like homelessness in parks, crime, other issues that weren't being addressed. I think some people simply didn't want to pay the tax.
Back in June, Brand tried to add his own sales tax initiative to the ballot with a vote from the city council. It would have enacted a sales tax increase and split the revenue between parks and the city police and fire departments. However, Brand withdrew his proposal within days of announcing it because he didn't have support from the council. He says that his opposition to Measure P came down to the 30-year lifetime of the tax and that it left out public safety, despite calling for clean and safe parks.
The fact is, through all the actual ballot, if you read the ballot, it talks about park rangers. It does not mention police officers.
Now, since the measure has failed, Brand says his hands are tied when it comes to increasing park funding.
There's a lot of needs out there. My job as mayor is to address all the needs, not just put all the, you know, all our eggs in one basket. And that, in my opinion, that's what they were asking me to do.
Brand says he sees potential for the two sides to collaborate, and there may be another tax initiative come 2020. In Woodward Park, Fresno residents Brian and Maria Junker tell me they wish the initiative had passed.
I'm kind of disappointed, didn't I? Think that they should actually invest more into the parks here.
Yeah, because this is why predominantly we come to the parks that are more well-kept. In our area, we do have a couple parks in our area, but it's still, they're not up to date.
Since Woodward Park has an entry fee, the Junkers pay $50 for an annual pass so they can come anytime year-round. they tell me why they drive so far from their Fresno High neighborhood home.
Well, because our parks kind of suck where we're at.
They're not as well kept as most other parks, so that's why we tend to come to the ones that are, you know, tend to be well kept.
But not everyone can afford a $50 park pass. In Southwest Fresno, you can enter most parks for free, but the one where Sandra Celadone and I meet is not as well kept as Woodward. There's trash everywhere. It's intermixed with leaves in the empty swimming and wading pools. As we talk, someone from the city parks department walks around with a trash grabber, putting wrappers and a forgotten shirt in a bag. You can see cars driving along Highway 99 on one side, and people wander through with shopping carts.
And what you see, this is one of the parks that is designated as one of the poorest conditions in our city.
Celadone tells me what she thinks could be updated in the park. Take the locks off the bathroom doors, swap out the wooden bleachers for new metal ones, and rake up the leaves and debris. Celadone wants to work with city leaders to improve parks like these, but she's hesitant.
So I think when you have a side that relies on untruths and relies on misinformation, it makes it really hard to sit at the table and have an honest conversation about how do we tackle the issues, which we know there are many.
This park is where Celadone wanted to meet, but she says it is not where the fight for parks ends. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui.
And now we move south to Tulare County. About a month ago, in mid-October, Tulare Regional Medical Center was in the middle of a makeover. In less than a week, it was due to reopen after closing abruptly a year earlier due to mismanagement. New pavement was still drying, and workers in forklifts were painting the whole building a uniform beige. Inside, beds were full of patients, fake patients. Doctors and nurses were running mock drills in the emergency room. Nurse Rick Albert was taking care of another nurse who was pretending to be a car crash victim named Jane.
We've tested your blood sugar. I'm going to test it again, and it's going to be in the lab results.
Albert and Jane were having some fun, but they took these drills seriously. They're a chance to test emergency responses as well as equipment and procedures.
Okay, Jane, we're doing really good. I'm going to keep checking on you, okay? I'll be right here.
They were practicing because on October 15th, Tulare Regional finally reopened. Then, last week, voters overwhelmingly supported Measure H, which will keep it running for up to 30 years. We're taking you to Tulare Regional because it's an example of what happens when a rural area is waiting for a local hospital. Just a few months earlier, this place was a ghost town. Only a skeleton crew was here, keeping the lights on and waiting for the day they could see patients again. One of those workers was nurse Charlene Dawson.
I was part of the staff that was here when it closed. That was a very, very sad day for all of us who work here, for this whole community. It was incredibly painful and very surreal.
Dawson is the director of the hospital's emergency department and intensive care unit. She says there's no question Tulare residents need a hospital.
Many of them have a lot of challenges, socioeconomic challenges, that make it very difficult for them to go to Visalia or to go to Porterville to receive their care.
But that's exactly what patients had to do for a year. Each day the hospital was closed, around 80 emergency patients had to go elsewhere, mostly to Cahuilla Delta Medical Center in Visalia, which at one point set up two tents in its parking lot as a makeshift waiting room. Ambulances, too, felt the impact. Jackie Paul, vice president of LifeStar Ambulance in Tulare, says paramedics had to drive further and wait longer with their patients.
It's affected our whole county. It's affected all of the ambulance companies because with our ambulances always going out of town, then the other companies have to come in and help cover our area.
The hospital had been mired in mismanagement and scandal for years. Its former governing board made a lot of bad decisions, and the company managing it eventually drove it to financial ruin. The board decided the only way to revive the hospital was to declare bankruptcy and shut it down. Larry Blitz is a crisis manager who took over as interim CEO while the hospital was closed.
Over my 40 years of managing hospitals and healthcare facilities, I had never seen anything so complicated, and the hole is so deep financially as this particular facility.
Here's a sampling of what went wrong. Financial bungling meant a construction project approved by voters in 2005 still isn't finished. Former board members have faced lawsuits and even been recalled for benefiting from potentially illegal decisions they made while on the board. And perhaps most egregiously, the district attorney recently seized $1 million from the CEO of the company that previously ran the hospital, called Healthcare Conglomerate Associates, or HCCA. He's under investigation for stealing even more money from the hospital. Kevin Northcraft is the president of the hospital's governing board, and he was elected in 2016 after much of this corruption was brought to light.
We're awaiting indictments and arrests, and we're hopeful that people who did bad things that harmed our community have justice served on them.
Today, the hospital is operated by Adventist Health, which owns a network of health centers and hospitals in Selma, Reedley, Bakersfield, and a dozen other locations across California. Adventist's Randy Dodd is the president of Tulare Regional, and he says things will be different now.
I don't know what happened prior with HCCA and where their profits may have gone, but I think based on what we see in our ability to run a hospital, that we'll be able to do it in a very effective way.
He argues Adventist is efficient and compassionate, and he says being part of a big network means they have access to more expertise. The revived Tulare Regional still has a lot of trust to build in the community. A small faction did oppose Measure H, though it passed with 88% of the vote. And even up to the election, many Tulare residents were still calling for more transparency from the board. Still, one thing that's not debated is the hospital is serving the community. According to Adventist, the emergency department treated 1,500 patients in its first 3 weeks, including its first call, which came while the ribbon was being cut on opening morning.
Last Tuesday, some people in Kern County were hoping District 4 residents would vote for a candidate that would make the Board of Supervisors more diverse. But it looks like the board is staying the same, with 4 white men and 1 Latina. The county was ordered to redraw its districts after a court ruled it violated the Voting Rights Act. Now there's a second district with a majority Latino population. FM 89's Monica Velez digs into why a Latino candidate wasn't able to win it.
Although election results are unofficial, it looks like Kern County Supervisor David Couch will represent District 4. On this day, we're cruising around his district in my hatchback. He starts by showing me the wealthiest part, Seven Oaks.
This is the nicest part as far as highest residential housing values in the 4th District right here. It's gated, big lots, big homes.
As we keep driving east toward Lamont, everything gets more rural and the roads get rockier. We end up in a community neighboring Lamont called Weed Patch.
This is really, really nice. People live here, but they live here in some pretty difficult conditions. Okay, make a left. Now stop right here and I want to describe this to you. This is Harold Street. This is a street that is literally paved on the left half and not on the right half.
Even though Couch got the most votes, a lot of efforts were made to see a Latino candidate in his seat. For one, there was a lawsuit filed by the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund, or MALDEF. It cost Kern County at least $5.5 million. After the districts were redrawn, District 4 had the best chance of getting a Latino supervisor, in part because it has a majority Latino population. So what happened?
Well, what happened is that we had a spoiler in the race.
That's Dolores Huerta, who's with the Dolores Huerta Foundation. She says one of the candidates, Jose Gonzalez, shouldn't have entered the race so the other candidate, Grace Vallejo, could win.
We begged him not to run. We told him if you run, you're going to split up the vote. And that means that David is going to ensure that David Couch is going to get elected. But of course, he didn't listen to us.
The foundation was instrumental in getting MALDEF to take the county to court. Huerta says because there were 2 Latino candidates running against Couch, the Latino vote got split.
Just add the numbers that Grace Vallejo got plus the numbers that Gonzalez got, and they would definitely overcome the numbers that Couch got in the election.
But no one can truly predict what the outcome would have been had only 1 Latino run. But what about the district map? Could it have been drawn in a way that would have made the Latino vote in District 4 stronger? Huerta thinks so.
We had submitted a stronger map to the when they were in the negotiations, but the map that we submitted wasn't considered. The negotiations were between the MALDEF and Committee from the Board of Supervisors and the plaintiffs, and even, although we were very involved in having all of this happen, we were not at the table when the final map was drawn, unfortunately.
MALDEF did not respond to requests for comment. But Supervisor Leticia Perez, who represents District 5, says the map was extensively scrutinized. She was on the board's committee that negotiated the final maps.
Essentially, five politicians were being asked to either reduce or increase their power willingly at the cost of another or more supervisors. So it was an incredibly tense, incredibly difficult process, one in which a very difficult issue of race and immigration and ultimately dwindling or growing power were very sensitive and fragile topics.
She says the committee looked at least a dozen versions. She calls the final map an incredible victory. She says that before the primaries, various Latino advocates, educators, and Democratic leaders came together to strategize the best way to get a Latino candidate elected.
It was an open brainstorming strategy session where everyone put their concerns out there. Everyone said, we want to work together. We don't want to split the Latino vote. We know that we'll lose if we do that. So will everyone in here agree to a process? And that was not an easy thing to procure. It took some discussion. It took some cajoling to say, look, this is a process that we can really make meaningful, and it will be representative of a huge percentage of support of the Latino community in Kern County.
Everyone at the meeting voted from a pool of candidates, and the choice was Vallejo. But when Gonzalez heard about this meeting, he was concerned.
This group said, well, that's the only two choices you have. It's either Couch or Vallejo. No, it's not. We as citizens have the responsibility, if we don't like our choices, to stand up and make change happen by running for office.
Gonzalez knows some people are upset with him, but he wasn't happy with his choice of candidates.
The people that are calling me the spoilers are the people that wanted to control the vote. We live in a democracy, and we can't have a democracy when we don't have the freedom to choose. And when someone tries, or a group of people get together to try and control, democracy hesitates to exist.
But Grace Vallejo says she had the bigger picture in mind when it comes to this race. She says a Latino candidate would better represent the population in her district.
If I had wanted to run for this seat and there was a group of individuals who were offering to support financially and every which way someone they felt could win, and I was doing it because I cared for the community and I saw that, absolutely I would step out.
But Couch says he can represent the district just as well as a Latino. Back in my hatchback, he tells me all the things he plans to do in places like Lamont and Weed Patch. He says he's already filled up about 200 potholes in the area and cleaned up some lots.
I think some people thought, for whatever reason, well, he used to represent that area, so he's not going to want to represent our area, which isn't true. I think, frankly, I have a tremendous opportunity here because there's so much that could be done. You don't have to look around for something to do. You just have to pick what you want to work on it and make an impact, do something positive.
And the three District 4 candidates will still have to work together in the future. Vallejo because she's the mayor of Delano, Gonzalez because he's the president of the Lamont Chamber of Commerce, and Couch, who kept his seat. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Monica Velez.
And now let's step back from our Election Day follow-up and zero in on Veterans Day. In honor of November 11th, we went to the Veterans Home of California in Fresno, where we heard from three vets about their experiences in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. Here is their audio postcard.
I'm Jim Appleton.
I remember in my youth we celebrated Armistice Day, which was a celebration of peace. And we need days to honor veterans. I just hope we have not forgotten peace is the real objective of warfare. Winning the peace after is what really counts. I was in the tail end of Korea and the front end of Vietnam. I was in the Army. I was a commissioned officer in the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Korea was a war that really proved the worth of the United Nations. And to that extent, it was somewhat unique and was needed. Vietnam, on the other hand, I think history will remember Vietnam as a war that probably did not offer any advantage to the United States. I was there very early. I went in, I spent exactly 365 days and 4 hours from April 1962 to April 1963. There were no U.S. combat units in South Vietnam at that time, but it was considered wartime service because we had very, at that time, super secret operation of using the defoliants known as Agent Orange. And because of that, it was wartime service. But we were mainly there to advise the and train Vietnamese troops. And I did experience a lot of, or observe, I should say, I didn't experience. I observed a lot of really questionable activity, ethically questionable activity. And it was a disappointment to me personally. It's very difficult when you are trying to make the military a career to be critical and really make yourself heard when you are in, you might say, disagreement, if not even opposition, with the situation that you're facing.
My name is Elsa Barry. Grew up in Los Angeles. My parents had just come over from Holland just before I was born. Yeah, 1922, and I was born in 23. My little brother went first because he was barely 18, didn't even graduate from high school. Well, he was he had finished high school, but he missed his graduation because he joined the Navy first. And I figured he wasn't going to have more fun than me, so I joined. I was a storekeeper in Navy Wave. It just meant that you were in the bookkeeping end of it and more working in office stuff rather than, we weren't allowed to go on board ships at that time. It wasn't until the end of the war when they finally started letting women go aboard ship. So nurses were the only ones that got to do that. So we did office work. I could have stayed in the military, but then I met my husband the last month he was stationed there. And I thought, well, instead of the military, I'll just settle for another. So we got married a year later. And like I say, 53 years, it was good duty. I wouldn't have done anything other than that, not only just for the duty part of it, but just for the experiences that I had while I was in the service. I think my next job description was having as many children as possible. I had six.
My name is Gordon Scott. I'm 96. I was in World War II.
I was in, went in 1940, was stationed aboard an aircraft carrier. We were in Pearl Harbor. We left out on Sunday morning, or on Saturday morning, before the Japanese hit on Sunday morning. We were on our way to Wake Island with a load of planes to reinforce it. And we turned around and tried to intercept the Japanese forces, which we never did. And it's lucky we didn't, because they'd blown us out of the water. Made it back. Eventually, we went into Pearl Harbor, seen the devastation that was there and all the ships that were sunk. And we provisioned and fueled up with everything and left out of that for the South Pacific and trying to find the Japanese again. And we were out at sea for about 105 days. The first ship I was on was sunk, and it was just found this year by another sea submarine that found it in the Coral Sea. And the other carrier I was on was hit in Leyte. Kamikaze went through the flight deck on the second one. Just thankful I'm here.
You heard from Jim Appleton, Elsa Berry, and Gordon Scott.
This year's ballot included a lot of bonds, but one of the most expensive ones had to do with water. Proposition 3 would have authorized nearly $9 billion for water projects. It passed in Fresno County, but failed across the state. FM89's Laura Satsui spoke with Sacramento Bee reporter Brian Anderson to find out why.
So Proposition 3, if passed by voters, it would have been an $8.9 billion bond measure that would have gone to help repair the Orville Dam and aid some of the Central Valley farmers who are facing groundwater contamination problems, potentially with just general water issues. And what's fascinating is that the history of water bonds has been fairly solid over the last three decades, but with voters rejecting it, it was the first real rejection of a water bond for since 1990, and it was a 9-0 streak up until this point. And the deficit has narrowed a bit from 54-46 to now 52-48, but the Associated Press has called Proposition 3 as being struck down, and that appears to be the case.
Yeah, it was a pretty, that's a pretty broad range of topics to cover. Infrastructure, you know, drinking water, and I know there was also some environmental restoration projects in there. And so with this proposition seeming to catch a lot of sides, who were some of the players here, the proponents and the oppositions?
Yeah, so Jerry Mill, he's quoted in our story as well, and he's a water policy advocate who's really the main sponsor of Proposition 3 and actually drafted the language of this initiative. And he said he would have fixed it in hindsight if he knew this was going to be the result. He called it, quote, a mystery as to why this didn't get passed. So it was a surprise for him, but he is a water policy advocate who thought this had a good shot at happening, but it came with a hefty price tag and voters perhaps could not look past that.
Did he say in what way he might have fixed it?
Well, it didn't seem that he offered too many specifics beyond just saying that it's hard to figure out why it didn't pass. It's a mystery, but he would have done some rewording and perhaps chopped the price tag down is what it sounded like he was suggesting. But obviously, this was very surprising for him, and he was sort of short on specifics and lost on what went wrong.
So being that California has passed water bonds, and this is the first one we've rejected or that voters have rejected since 1990, I mean, what were in the water bonds of the past that voters have approved?
Well, it looks like voters have approved past measures that added more accountability measures, and this proposition would have provided a more direct pathway to farmers receiving grants. So in the past, money has been allocated through this state budgetary process, whereas Proposition 3 was going to have money paid through grants directly to the farmers and other groups that would have potentially be spending this money. So that accountability aspect is one thing that's different about Proposition 3 than the 9 water bonds that have been passed before in the last few decades.
In your article from the SACB, you mentioned that, a lack of accountability is something that troubled Proposition 3's critics. I mean, would you say, I don't know, was that the primary thing that people who opposed it cited?
I'd say that was a primary thing. I'm not sure what the primary reason is. It's still something that's being looked at as to a postmortem of why Prop 3 failed, and it's still fairly early to say if the main advocate of the initiative can't really elaborate on what happened exactly and still calls it a mystery. It's something that is largely an open question. But if you look at why it failed, one other reason is that voters might have felt that this had been done before. If you ask Governor Jerry Brown, he had his suspicions that people were just maybe tired of water bonds getting through and wanted to see their tax dollars spent perhaps more conservatively than in the past. So that's one guiding force, I would say. But I'm not sure at this point in time whether we can say something is the cause.
And then from the main proponent of this bond, Jerry Morrall, did he mention whether there's a chance that he'll try and bring this up again and, you know, potentially with different language? Is that a possibility?
I did not hear that from him. It's certainly possible that there's going to be more water bonds in the future, just based on us having now about 10 over the last few decades. So I certainly don't think this is going to be an end to the issue of water insecurity and groundwater contamination and projects that could help fund environmental restorations. I don't think this is the end to the issue. Whether or not Jerry Morrall will have another initiative in the future, I'm not quite sure yet.
What about the Governor Jerry Brown? What were his thoughts on this water bond in particular?
Well, Governor Brown, as he usually does, declined to state how he voted on this. He did say he voted for Governor-elect Gavin Newsom, but wouldn't speak to Proposition 3. But what he did say that was very surprising to me in a news conference right after Election Day with reporters. We asked about Proposition 3 and why it might have failed, and he said it's hard to say. And that quote, it might be there were so many bonds, and that was his words. And for someone who's been an environmental advocate in California and has really brought this issue to the forefront of California politics in many ways, it sort of took me aback a little bit that he would say there are so many of these bonds and sort of signaling that voters might be tired of it.
And was he referring to so many bonds regarding water or so many bonds just on the ballot in general?
I think he was speaking specifically to the water bonds of the past and how it had gone basically 9-0 in the win-loss column since 1990, and that maybe this was just a case of voters not wanting to see more of these.
Well, we've been speaking with Brian Anderson, political reporter at the Sacramento Bee. You covered the elections and sort of what has happened since as we watched these results roll in. And we've been speaking about Proposition 3, a water bond that would have benefited the state of California. Thanks so much for being with us, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
And now back to Fresno County, where we find one of the few local upsets in last week's elections. Sanger City Council member Melissa Hurtado will be the next state senator to govern District 14, which covers parts of Fresno, Tulare, Kings, and Kern counties. She beat out Republican Andy Vidak by 8 percentage points in what will likely be the only state Senate race in which the incumbent was unseated. I spoke with 30-year-old Hurtado a few days ago while her victory was still provisional. We talked about her background as a health advocate and the daughter of Mexican immigrants and how she's coming to grips with her somewhat unexpected victory.
You know, I was never really expected to accomplish a lot of the things that I have in my life. You know, I was not expected to graduate from high school. I was expected not to go to college. I was expected to do, things were supposed to be different. And so I don't like things to be status quo for me or for anybody else. And I knew that the odds were kind of stacked against me because, you know, running against an incumbent that's really likable. And all I could do is just really try and just communicate with the voters. And that's what I did. And that's it. I could just give it my all.
And so most recently, you've been on the Sanger City Council. This was your first term. You were elected in 2016. How did that experience inform, you know, what you would then want to do as a state senator?
It just made me realize that the problems and challenges that we face on the Sanger City Council were challenges that were beyond the city council, beyond the city. For example, homelessness or, you know, poverty or the lack of jobs. And so, you know, I saw what other state senators and assembly members have been able to do across the state and how they've been able to deliver resources for their districts. And I felt that we weren't getting our fair share.
And what made you, you know, you said earlier, you told us earlier before this conversation that you never really thought that you'd be running for office. But now you're already on the Sanger City Council, and then you could very well become the next state senator in District 14. What made you decide to run for to be a state senator, and what made you choose this district?
Well, I grew up in this district. I was born in this district, and it's an extension of why I decided to run for city council in the first place, and that's that I felt that there weren't job opportunities, and I want to be able to say and do actually create job opportunities and have access to healthcare. And those are things that I campaigned when I ran for city council. We had a hospital in Sanger. I talk about that all the time, and that hospital closed down. So if we want, if we need emergency services, we need to drive half an hour to get to a hospital. And that's really a matter of life or death. And it's something that at the city level, it's just difficult to really, you know, try to change that. And so that's why I decided to take this on. And really, that's what it's all about.
And you mentioned health. You have experience working for a health advocacy organization, and you certainly campaigned on a lot of health platforms. And you also explained that you used to work for Planned Parenthood also. And so what would be your main priorities as a state senator?
So my top priorities would be jobs, you know, healthcare, education, and water. I mean, I feel that you can't just focus in on one more than the other. I feel that we really need a master plan for the district that, incorporates all four of those issues.
And to a certain extent, your election does make sense politically. You know, District 14 is majority Democrat, or at least plurality Democrat. And so voting for you was, in a way, kind of a return to Democratic leadership. But at the same time, your district does overlap David Valadao's. And he, of course, is a Republican in the U.S. House of Representatives, and he easily won his reelection this past week. What does that tell you about the constituents that you're now working for?
It tells me that they vote with their heart. I mean, I really don't know. I mean, I on my end, I just did what I could and went out to the community, talked to people, and, you know, we connected.
You are the daughter of immigrants. And in this past election, we have, of course, heard about races all over the country in which women, in many cases, women of color, defeated their whiter, generally older counterparts. You know, should this come through and you win this particular race, do you feel like you're part of something bigger happening in other parts of the country?
I think to a certain extent, yes. But I also think it was a message in the vision. Yeah, voters care about healthcare. Voters care about jobs. And while being a woman and getting more women elected is important and is important to the voters, I think that their livelihood is much more important to them, and they want to have the best person that's going to be able to deliver for them. And I feel that the voters in Senate District 14, as you know, based on what it looks like, they felt that I was the person that could be able to deliver for them.
And do you feel like you were able to relate better to some of the constituents here because of your background?
I mean, I feel like I can relate to a lot of the voters here in the district. I think that's part of the reason why I ended up doing so well. I was out knocking on doors and making phone calls and going to community events and not just saying, hey, can I have your support? It was me going into their homes, talking about them, talking about their challenges, what, you know, their vision for the district. And we connected over our, you know, our shared visions, our shared challenges. And I think that's what made the difference.
Okay. Well, Melissa Hurtado is the Democratic challenger of State Senator Andy Vidak. Melissa Hurtado, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've heard stories and reports about how widespread the opioid crisis has become. But what about the loved ones of those caught in addiction, their family and friends? In her first book, Central Valley author Tina Hogan Grant writes about this from her own perspective. Her book is called Reckless Beginnings, and it's based in part on her own life experience, watching her sister suffer from a substance use disorder. FM89's Laura Satsui spoke with Hogan Grant to get a preview of her story.
So this book is a work of fiction, but based on true events from your own life. Can you talk a little bit about where that line is drawn?
Sure, no problem. The book is based on myself. Tammy Mellows, the main character, is myself. And it takes place, begins when she is 14 years old. I decided to write it as fiction and not a memoir, basically because I myself do not like the language of a memoir. It's basically written in first person, where it's I, me, and I wanted it to read like a story. 80% of this book is pretty much true to life. The towns have been changed, the names of characters have been changed, and a few events have been changed a little bit, but it's pretty much based on my life. I just prefer to write in a third person storyline, and that gives the reader a more insight of not just the first person. I can give you thoughts on the other characters when I write in third person. So that's why I decided to write it as fiction.
When you are giving thoughts from other characters, you know, being that they are people from your real life, how did you have conversations, you know, after these things had happened that gave you insight? Like, how were you able to sort of write that, I guess, in retrospect?
Many of the characters are my family members. When you read through the book, there's Donna, that's my sister that ran away from home, and then my father and my stepmother. And then these people I knew pretty well, and we did have conversations during this time of my life, so I could pretty much understand what they were feeling, what they were going through. So I think I did a good job on reading their minds.
For sure. And there are so many really heavy moments in this. You're not just talking about addiction, but also sort of familial strife. You mentioned your sister runs away, she goes missing, and it kind of goes on. And that sounds like it might be a difficult story to tell, but what motivated you to just put it all out there and write this?
I had the idea for this book about 25 years ago. That's when these events took place in my life. And when I started writing it, I gave it the theme of the flip side to addiction. We don't really hear from the loved ones of addicts. And when I was going through this, I was looking for any kind of books written by a woman that was going through what I was going through, because I wanted some kind of connection with somebody, and I needed to know how they coped, what did they do. And when I was looking, I came up empty. I only found books on how to, you know, they're telling me to do not do this, not do that. But I didn't have the actual voice of someone that was actually going through it. And that's when I decided that I needed to write about my experiences, not only for my own therapy, my own peace of mind, and to understand why I allowed this to happen to myself, but also for other women. Or and it could be any family member that, you know, is a loved one of an addict. And it just gives that person comfort. It shows them that they're not alone, and that there is venues where you can start taking your life back and realize that your life is not second because you're with an addict. You have to treat your life as number one. And it took me 25 years to actually write the book, and that's basically because life got in the way. But when I did start writing it, I gave myself the title The Silent and Forgotten One, because that's pretty much what we became, or I became. We become recluse. We don't tell our friends. We're embarrassed. We're ashamed. And at the time, you know, I just wanted to reach out to these people. But when I was writing these actual events, it was hard to open those doors again after 25 years. And I was quite stunned by how it affected me, because I had to show the emotions through my writing. So I had to reopen the wounds and go back to how I was feeling. So it was pretty difficult.
So these events happened, as you said, 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. And obviously how we talk about drug abuse and addiction has changed over the years. Maybe we talk about it more, especially with regards to the opioid crisis. Mm-hmm. But my perception is that maybe 25 years ago, you know, we weren't talking about these things as much. And so if you were a family member or friend of someone who was addicted to substances, it was really taboo and really hard. Do you feel like that has changed to today, where the conversation is more open, or is it still just very stigmatized?
I think it is more open because of the opioid addiction. The opioid addiction has increased the heroin addiction because of the prescription drugs being so expensive that people are actually turning to heroin because it's a third of the cost.
Right.
So even though this happened decades ago, the use of heroin has increased tremendously. And I think because of the prescription attachment to the addiction, people are talking about it more, and people aren't as recluse or, I guess, ashamed. But the fact is, with the heroin, I think when it comes to the point of where people are using the needles, I think that still is a cutoff, that people won't admit to it, or they just don't bring it up. But the word addiction is more acceptable today.
And your background is not necessarily in writing. You grew up in England, and then after coming to America, you were in commercial fishing. And so how did you weave, I guess, your career to this moment?
I've always loved to write. In fact, I have a sequel coming out to this book called Better Endings, and I also am going to be doing a prequel, which is The Journals of Tammy. Because when I was going through this at the young age of 14, the way I talked to my sister was through journals. Mm-hmm. And when I was going through the events with the addict, my escape was to write my frustrations, my thoughts, my ideas, my dreams in journals. And my father was also an author. So I was brought up around books. I've always loved to write. He was a huge influence on my writing. And I told my, and this book has always been in the back of my mind, someday just write it. And 2010, my father unexpectedly passed away. And then a year later, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And that's when I told myself, if I'm going to write this book, I better get serious about it. So in 2011, that's when I started writing down the outline and doing, you know, little chapters here and there. And then when we moved up here to the mountains, I was able to concentrate more and actually get it completed.
Can you talk a little bit about the light moments that readers can look forward to? You know, it's kind of like there's all this happening, but there's also hope. And what can readers sort of expect out of that?
Well, it's a book about a young girl coming of age. She's 14, and one of the dreams for her is to come to America. That is one of her father and her, one of her older sisters, did move to America due to the divorce, and her dream was to come to America. She'd been there during her school holidays, and when she finally does come, it's a celebration when she leaves England, and her dreams are fulfilled. She's finally here. And then, yes, the dark moments do start, but she hangs on to the hope of living that suburban family lifestyle. And it gives a lot of women hope. Just hang on to your dreams and keep moving forward and just don't give up.
Almost a modern American dream still.
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm.
That is all the time we have, but we have been speaking to Tina Hogan Grant. She is a longtime resident of Fraser Park, and she just published her first book. It's called Reckless Beginnings, and it's available to order online. You can find it on her website or barnesandnoble.com as well. Tina, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And finally, we'd like to end the show with two poems. The Central Valley lost an acclaimed poet last month, Peter Everwine. Everwine taught English literature and creative writing at Fresno State for 29 years. He was the recipient of an esteemed Guggenheim Fellowship, as well as a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts. Everwine died in Fresno on October 28th at the age of 88. Here he is reading his poem, In the Last Days, for the FM 89 program Valley Writers Read in 2003.
In the last days of my father's illness, he lived on, separate from us, in a tiny room with a window in it, where we might look in and watch him laboring at his heavy sleep. And only once did he startle up from the pillow, wide-eyed, and slapped one palm across the other. "Psst," he said, and smiled, and shook his head as if in disbelief, down into sleep again. I don't know what my father saw then, wandering in some mazy episode of time. That was 40 years ago, 40 years like yesterday. Almost his own age now, I can see his face before me, his wry smile of wonder, as if something had leapt up underfoot in the dark and sped away as he watched.
And here is Peter Everwine reading his poem, Night.
In the lamplight falling on the white tablecloth, my plate, my shining loaf of quietness, I sit down. Through the open door, all the absent I love enter, and we eat.
That was the poet Peter Everwine, who died last month. And that's today's Valley Edition. You can find all this and more on our website, kvpr.org, or download the podcast. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Valley Public Radio, and on Twitter at KVPR.
Did you know we have an app? It's called KVPR, and it's available for free in app stores on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by me, my co-host Alice Daniel, and reporters Laura Satsui and Monica Velez. Our audio engineer is Marv Allen, and Don Weaver is our production and operations manager. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Alice Daniel. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.